Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Breakers, a podcast about shipwrecks, loss, and lessons learned from maritime disasters. My name's Tanner. I'll be one of your hosts today, as usual. And as usual, I'm here with Taylor.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Before we jump in here today, we actually have three patrons we want to thank. So I want to give thanks to Missy, Jacob, and Jamie for joining us over on Patreon.
Yeah, that's awesome. It was great to get three people in a week. That was really cool. So we definitely appreciate that.
Yeah, we appreciate the support. We're working to, you know, always keep improving, keep diversifying that bonus content for you. You know, same with the show as a whole. And the more support we're getting, the easier it is to do that, really. We appreciate that so much from all of our patrons. Mm-hmm. I guess our next thing we should get to is... what have you been up to?
Not a lot. Work's been busy. Did manage to finish The Guns of August, finally.
Oh, awesome.
That was really good. That's a good read. If anybody's looking for something about the lead up to World War I, it's definitely a good one. Still pertinent today, too. It's interesting.
That's such a great book. She's such a great writer of history because of the gravity she can give to it. She has another book called A Distant Mirror, The Calamitous 14th Century, I believe. It was very good. It sort of follows a French nobleman through his lifetime from a nonfiction perspective. It was really cool. Barbara Tuchman's a great writer.
Yeah. Yep. That was my big accomplishment for the week.
That's cool. Let's see. For me, I've been binging season 5 of The Last Kingdom on Netflix. Nice. That's been my big thing. That's a show that whenever I sit down to watch it, I always have to watch like 3 episodes. Mm-hmm. Those are great. I really loved the Bernard Cornwell Saxon stories. I started reading those when I was in, like, I think they came out when I was in, like, middle school. I really liked those. So I was obviously very excited when they made that into a TV show.
Yeah.
Season 5 is very
good.
I've
seen a lot on Twitter about that. A lot of people talking about that.
Mm-hmm. In terms of reading, I finished the novel Mornings in Jenin by Susan Abulhawa. I also realized that I very often talk about starting books on this podcast, but I very rarely talk about finishing them. I do... often finish these books I talk about. Mornings in Jenin, it's a really cool, it's like a multi-generational family story. It's set in Palestine, the U.S., and Lebanon. Mm-hmm. It starts out with the Nakba in 1948. Mm-hmm. And it continues through all of the obvious, like the various wars and occupations in Palestine and Lebanon through the present day. I think the coolest thing about it is the way that the author really interweaves humor and positivity with the obvious numerous tragedies that have to happen in that book.
Mm-hmm, right.
And it leaves you with a very real sort of connection with the characters because that's sort of how life works. These tragic events happen really abruptly and they're presented in really stark language. And they're often, you know, so fast that you don't quite process what has happened and you have to sort of go back and reread to make sure that you understood what's going on. I thought it was a really great read. I would definitely recommend that to anyone who's interested in good books.
Yeah, it sounds like a very interesting book.
Well, speaking of tragedies, let's get down to the business of the day.
Let's talk about one.
We've got one today. We're going to talk about the sinking of the SS Brother Jonathan.
All right.
So a little bit of background about the Brother Jonathan. Brother Jonathan was a sidewheel steamer built in 1850 in Williamsburg, New York, at the shipyards of Perrin, Patterson, and Stack. Her construction came at the request of Edward Mills, who was a New York businessman looking to profit off of the newly increased demand for passage to California. Mm-hmm. You'll notice she was built in 1850, just after that whole gold rush thing kicked off.
Right.
So an interesting bit about her name, and specifically the cultural associations that it would have had at the time that are probably lost on most of us today, myself included, before I started researching this. Brother Jonathan was a symbolic figure who represented the concept of the Northern Yankee spirit. So very much akin to what we would think of with like Uncle Sam.
Right.
How he's sort of used as an embodiment of the nation, or, you know, how we use John Bull to represent the UK.
That's interesting because yeah, I'd not really heard of Brother Jonathan either.
Yeah, he sort of lost out on the popularity contest to Uncle Sam.
Is it sort of a pre-Civil War phenomenon? Like, is it something
somewhat
and goes away after the Civil War?
Yeah, and it's definitely more of a part of the national identity there, or regional identity. Like so many things after the Civil War, it's kind of this big cataclysmic rejoining of the nation that kind of leaves the national identity much more unified. Mm-hmm. You know, even with things like looking at old legal documents, a lot of very early stuff, the United States is treated as plural, just right. grammatically, saying the United States are, whereas now we say the United States is. So yeah, it's kind of an example of that sort of national culture developing over top of regional ones. And if you even look at drawings of Brother Jonathan, you will find that he looks suspiciously similar to Uncle Sam. He's kind of a tall, you know, skinny-legged guy. Uh-huh. Sometimes he has a wispy beard. He usually has a same sort of, you know, big top hat that he's wearing. So, yeah, I mean, after the Civil War, Brother Jonathan is kind of subsumed into that character, leaving us with just the Uncle Sam that we have today.
Interesting.
So in addition to obviously being patriotic, Brother Jonathan represented the spirit of capitalism and industriousness that was so popular at the time. Mm-hmm. In a lot of the depictions of Brother Jonathan, he's usually like exceptionally skinny. Uh-huh. And he's depicted wearing clothes that are like too small for him.
Interesting.
I guess to show that he's like thrifty. I assume that's why. And that he's not concerned with like outward appearances. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's Brother Jonathan.
Interesting.
And in the early part of the 19th century, this had kind of just become a nickname for any sailor out of New England. In other contexts, you just have this standing in for the United States as a whole. But it's an interesting bit of cultural history I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And now that we have that cultural knowledge, let's talk about the ship herself. So Brother Jonathan was 220 feet long and 36 feet wide.
Nice. Give me those ship facts. That's what we're here for.
She had two masts in addition to her vertical beam engine, and her two paddle wheels were each 33 feet in diameter.
This is like getting into the like time period of where you have like the overlapping of the engines and the masts, and you start getting into that cool stuff. It's an interesting time period.
For the more mechanically inclined, she had a 72-inch diameter cylinder and an 11-foot piston stroke.
Cool.
So in terms of capacity, something I do understand, she had accommodations for 350 passengers.
Okay.
She was most likely equipped at first with four lifeboats, two on each side. I say most likely because all of the depictions of her are from the side. There's not like a good schematic of her.
Right.
So in the source that I primarily use for this, estimated that she probably did in fact carry four, which makes sense.
Right.
When she launched in November of 1850, total costs had come to around $190,000.
Okay. So that, I mean, that's a decent chunk of money, right?
Good chunk of money in 1850. She started her operations in March of 1851, making the run from New York to Chagres in Panama, which is modern-day Colón in Panama.
Okay.
So note that this was the same route that was run by our old friend, the SS Central America.
Yeah. Yeah, it is, isn't it?
There's actually a lot of similarities between the two ships, both mm-hmm. in their style of build and the operations that they were part of.
And the fact that we're talking about both of them.
And the fact that they're on our show is another one. So she only ran this route for about a year before the ship changed hands.
Uh-huh.
She now came under the ownership of an individual that many of our listeners probably know, Mr. Cornelius Vanderbilt.
Interesting. That's the first time he's made an appearance here, I think, actually.
I think so. Yeah, for as much as we talk about this time period, this is his first appearance. Vanderbilt, obviously a huge name in American history and the growth of the railroad and shipping industries. All of his business stuff, it made him not only one of the richest Americans of his time, but one of the richest men ever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, ever. He wanted to get involved with this. Vanderbilt, just like Edward Mills, he saw this opportunity to make some money on this booming demand for passage to California. But he already had ships for this purpose on the Atlantic side.
Mm-hmm.
He needs some for the Pacific side. So his idea being, this way, you know, instead of working in partnership with other companies, people can get on a Vanderbilt ship in New York, take it down to Panama, get on a Vanderbilt ship the other side of Panama, and take it to San Francisco. He wants to be in charge of the whole thing.
Yeah, I imagine that helps too, because like it helps you sell the route when mm-hmm. you can control all the scheduling, like you can control capacity. No one's getting stuck anywhere because everything's planned out. Like, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for this purposes, he acquired Brother Jonathan. This would be her new theater of operation, in the Pacific. So to do this, she underwent a pretty thorough overhaul, to the point really that she was essentially taken apart and rebuilt.
Okay.
The most important change here from a operational perspective was her increase in capacity. So she would now be able to accommodate up to 750 passengers.
Okay, that's a lot more.
That's a lot more. That's more than double her previous capacity of 350. They moved some things around. They expanded some stuff. They just made more space to pack people into this thing. Other changes included a third mast.
Okay.
More masts, more fun. That's what we say.
I was just about to say that.
So her new rigging also would be a little bit different. Her foremast was square rigged. She had a yardless main mast. This mast wasn't new, but it did change position from its previous one.
Okay.
And the new schooner rigged mizzen mast. The mizzen is the aftmost mast on a ship that has three or more.
Nice.
She would also now run with 6 lifeboats. More lifeboats, more fun.
More lifeboats, more fun.
But obviously, how much safety that really provided is dubious.
Right.
So quoting from Alfred Lomax in Brother Jonathan, Pioneer Steamship of the Pacific Coast. This is actually my primary source for the whole episode. So throughout, if I quote something and I forget to attribute it to a specific source, it's probably from Lomax. So quoting here, apparently safety was a nearly unknown, meaningless word in the lexicon of shipping men in those days, and few, if any, measures were taken to assure reasonable adherence to common sense safety requirements for either passengers or cargo. Criminal negligence and ignorance permeates 19th century maritime history, and the equipment of the Brother Jonathan evidenced no exception.
It's quite the quote.
Owned by Alfred Lomax here. So in the days before the Panama Canal, obviously you had to sail all the way down around South America and then back up the West Coast. So once she was outfitted for that, you know, she's ready to go. She's ready to get out west and start running these other routes. A bit more about that route. We alluded to this a little bit in our Central America episode. In the days before the canal, obviously, those passengers, when you get down there on your ship from New York, you've got to go over land.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no super, super easy way to do that.
Right.
So yeah, you're crossing the isthmus. You're going through the jungle of either Panama or Nicaragua. And it's pretty rough country, despite the fact that this is an established route. And that obviously sounds a bit like roughing it, but it may have actually been more of a break than it seems.
Mm-hmm.
Quoting here from Lomax again. The inconveniences of this land crossing by muleback, river and lake boat, pick-a-back, and just plain walking, although not pleasant, were to some a welcome relief from the overcrowded conditions of the ship. Passenger space at such a premium, people were jammed into unsanitary quarters close to the engine room and the galley where the atmosphere was stifling.
Yeah, I can imagine, like, after being crowded on there, like, all you want to do is get fresh air and not be there anymore.
Yeah, it's similar to what we talked about in our prison ships episode. Mm-hmm. Do I want to go serve in the West Indies and die of malaria? No, but it's fresh air.
I think, too, like, it's clear here, like, the goal is to pack more people on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is purely for immigration purposes, so there's no luxury involved in this.
Correct. Demand for the passage on these routes was massive. You know, some of these ships carried up to, like, 1,000 people. And again, you see these ships, at least in their original capacities, are usually built for 200 to 300.
Yeah. It reminds me of a quote from Phil Castellini, actually. Where else are you going to go?
Perfect.
And, in my case, it's just to not watch the Reds be awful. But in these people's case, I suppose you didn't really have a choice if you wanted to go to California.
Who do you think had a worse last 30 days? The Cincinnati Reds or the Russian Black Sea Fleet?
I don't know. They're both sinking, so it's not great.
So obviously a lot of ships were needed to fill this demand, so much so that even old retired sailing ships were brought back in to operation.
Awesome.
Even though they'd been, you know, retired in favor of these new steamships. Prices given by Lomax in that article are $180 for a first class ticket and $75 for steerage.
The lack of space between those price points makes me think there's not that much of a difference.
Yes, I mean, $75 for steerage seems very steep.
And like $180 for a first class ticket is honestly less than I would expect.
Yeah.
Which to me just means like the amenities aren't there. Like we're not talking about the Titanic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, don't worry. For the discerning passenger, some tickets were priced as high as $250. depending on the ship, the accommodation, how fancy you wanted to travel. Brother Jonathan arrived in San Francisco for the first time on May 14th, 1852. In July, she began carrying passengers from San Francisco down to San Juan del Sur on the Pacific coast of Nicaragua. Some of Vanderbilt's competitors on this run were the New York and San Francisco line, the Empire City line, which later became the New York and California Steamship Company, and the Pacific Mail Steamship Company. The Pacific Mail Steamship Company, we've kind of seen before. They had an operating agreement with the U.S. Mail Steamship Company, who operated returning champion Central America.
So many steamship companies.
Yeah, really. Like, there's a lot of them, and they're doing the exact same thing. So this is kind of a saturated market in terms of operating a steamship company. I think that's what a saturated market is, right?
Yeah, kind of, maybe.
You could
use it that way. Yeah, there's a lot of companies playing for the same people.
They're on the water. Everything is wet. It's a saturated market. In either late 1852 or early 1853, Vanderbilt's interests in both Atlantic and Pacific routes came under the ownership of the Accessory Transit Company, specializing in the trip across Nicaragua.
Okay.
I say came under the ownership of because I don't understand what happened. I read about it, and there's a lot of like shady backroom business stuff happening, and it seems like Vanderbilt sort of got screwed out of his ownership stake by one of his partners. I don't know how it went down, but when the dust all settles, Vanderbilt no longer owns this stuff.
I feel like maybe at the time he was upset, and then like when this happened, he's probably like, well, it worked out.
I think he had enough money to console himself somehow.
That's true. Yeah, it would have just been a blip on his radar.
Buy an extra tub of ice cream. It's noted in that Lomax article, it was possible for passengers to make the trip from New York to San Francisco in just 24 days. But that wasn't the norm. That sounds pretty good compared to your Oregon Trail dysentery stuff.
Yeah, and I guess that's interesting, too, that like even the steerage people, like these aren't like the poorest of the poor necessarily. Like I feel like these are probably the people that occupy like lower and middle class type things.
We'll talk a little bit about the gold rush here. And I think that's one of the sort of enduring images of the gold rush is you kind of have this idea of like a solitary miner in like ragged clothes, striking it rich when he discovers a gold nugget in a river. And, you know, when in fact, a lot of these people going out west were decently well off. I mean, they weren't desperate for some sort of success. They already had, you know, decent amounts of money.
Yeah, because you have to have that ability to move.
Yeah, and that's how they had the resources to go out there in the first place. So, yeah, that's a very good point. Even the, you know, the worst seat in the house on one of these is pretty decent.
And I would think would also be better than walking next to a wagon with some ox for, you
know,
miles every day.
For sure. So, yeah, that's another thing important to note. You know, we talk about the people hoping to get rich in the gold fields. You also do have a large number of people who are moving west just to take advantage of the newly available farmlands in California and Oregon.
And I would imagine, too, like, you know, if you're like a saloon owner in Michigan or a store owner in Michigan, like you see this opportunity, you're like, well, I can sell all my stuff here and just go do this there where there's a lot, you know, new demand.
Yeah, where there's like everyone would love to have this store. They would love to have a Skyline Chili on the West Coast.
That's why they exist in Florida now.
Exactly. People would go crazy for this. You got a lot of farmers going out there, too. A lot of farmers, miners, not just for gold, but for other stuff, too. How that farmland became available, best not to ask. So yeah, you know, while finding gold may have had that higher upper limit of potential, these people were just kind of going out to sort of see what they could do with farming. And a lot of those would-be miners ended up heading back east, not really finding anything. In all of this, Brother Jonathan was a popular and well-liked vessel. Quote here from Lomax, "The ship presented so impressive an appearance when it was fully illuminated at night with its glittering, reflecting ornaments that it vied with the drawing room of an imperial palace. Oil cloth of a bright and variegated pattern covered the floor. Crimson cushioned settees and chairs provided comfortable reading and writing facilities."
It's interesting that like it's nice, but it's also way overcrowded. I think it also goes to further prove that point that like these aren't like poor destitute people. Like all of these people are probably, you know, they have some sort of asset, you know, that they were able to sell or something to get to this point.
even stuff like the mention of reading and writing facilities, the fact that you've got these like middle class businessmen who are there, they're going to need space, you know, temporary office space and stuff like that. So Brother Jonathan ran on this route between San Juan and San Francisco until 1857. There was a brief stoppage of these routes in 1856 due to some political upheaval in Nicaragua.
I've never heard of that before.
Involving someone that we have also briefly mentioned before, the American adventurer slash filibuster slash very short tenured unrecognized president of Nicaragua, William Walker.
I know him.
Once again, the podcast Behind the Bastards with Robert Evans has some wonderful in-depth coverage of William Walker that we recommend checking out. Fascinating fellow, terrible person, but just very interesting.
He's definitely one of those people that lived a life that would be impossible today, and like awful person, but like interesting.
Yes. You can't just go rogue and start a slave colony in Central America.
There's almost like a Mark Twain story element to him. He would fit in that.
He's the Wario of Mark Twain. but back to our episode here. The completion of the Panama Railroad in 1855 allowed for much quicker transit across the isthmus. For an extra $50 to $75, passengers could disembark from their ship, board the train, and get back on another ship 40 miles across the isthmus, cutting out that, you know, pretty arduous and probably disease-ridden trek across the jungles of Central America.
I think that's also how you weeded out the, like, those who had a little extra cash and those who didn't.
So in 1857, Brother Jonathan was sold to Captain John T. Wright in his merchant's accommodation line. So Wright had been involved in the Atlantic coastal shipping trade prior to coming to San Francisco in 1849. He was actually one of the successful participants in the gold rush. But as you can see, that kind of highlights that point of if you're a already established businessman, you can go west and have the resources to set up, you know, a decent mining camp, and you have people that you can hire, and you have, you know, tools that you can bring or you can purchase. You're probably getting the best stuff, probably have access to better locations to do this. So lots of factors in play here beyond just getting lucky. Wright's plan for the ship was to use her on routes from San Francisco north to Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. So finally get her first real big change in usage here. The ship would, however, operate under the name Commodore. Whether or not that was a nod to Cornelius Vanderbilt himself, I don't know.
I feel like it has to be, right?
Because that was like his nickname. So I feel like it'd be weird to name it that and not have him in mind since he just owned it.
You knew what you were doing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that was meant as like a tip of the cap to him or just like, I've got your ship now. I don't know. But anyway, regardless, she was operating as the Commodore. So for the next few minutes here, if I'm talking about the Commodore, I'm talking about Brother Jonathan. So when gold was discovered on the Fraser River in British Columbia in 1858, it was the Commodore that brought that news to San Francisco. J.T. Wright was very, very quick to place the first advertisement for the ship in the local papers. He was definitely on the ball here. The Daily Evening Bulletin ran the following ad. In consequence of the favorable news received from Fraser's River, the undersigned has been induced to put on the well-known steamship Commodore, which will sail from Pacific Wharf on Tuesday, April 20th, 1858, at 10 o'clock a.m., touching at Mendocino, Trinidad, Crescent City, Port Orford, and Victoria, Vancouver's Island, connecting with steamship Seabird at Port Townsend for all ports on Puget Sound. For freight and passage, apply on board at Pacific Wharf or to J.T. Wright, 89 Front Street, upstairs.
I love it. That was awesome.
So yeah, he's on this right away. He's like, he's getting ads in all these papers. He's saying, hey, this is what's up. I've got a ship. Let's go.
In business, this is what we call the first mover's advantage.
Yes.
Since they brought the news, they were able to capitalize very quickly.
Exactly. So on this first trip north, she carried around 300 passengers, disembarking them at Esquimalt.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Thank you to various Canadians on YouTube that I was able to find saying Esquimalt. I hope I'm repeating it correctly.
It looks kind of like how it sounds, but it also looks like a word you wouldn't say like how it looks.
Yeah,
you know?
I definitely had no idea how to say it. So thank you to Canadians everywhere. quoting here from the Daily Alta California, the good people of Victoria were at church when we arrived and were perfectly astounded when they came out and beheld 400 and 500 Yankees armed with revolvers and Bowie knives.
Oh, look, the Americans are here.
Yep, that's them. That reminds me of the Neuronic episode where the guy's like, you could tell who the Americans were in the dining room because of the way that they were eating. Very uncouth people, Americans. The gold strike on the Fraser River, it proved financially beneficial for J.T. Wright, though it was pretty short-lived compared to California, and it sputtered out after about 5 months. In this time, thousands of Californians went north to try their luck. One reporter claimed as many as 20,000. I have no idea. That seems like a massive population shift for this. But
it does.
It's, you think about the number of ships that are running these routes. If they're each carrying a few hundred people, it's possible. But yeah, the Fraser River gold strike didn't really last that long here. The first real incident of note in Brother Jonathan / Commodore's operating history came in July 1858. Commodore didn't arrive as scheduled in Victoria, so you've got to figure for such a routine trip, a ship that people know, a ship that people expect to see every few days, if she doesn't show up on time, there's a reason for concern.
Right.
So she had encountered stormy weather 2 days after leaving San Francisco, and she was forced to turn back due to a major leak. She was taking on enough water that it extinguished her boiler fires.
Okay, that's not great.
And, of course, her pumps were clogged and unusable.
Mm-hmm.
So Captain George Staples at this point ordered all cargo on deck thrown overboard and for passengers to assist in bailing water from the ship.
That has to be a bad feeling.
So on returning to San Francisco, a group of angry passengers confronted J.T. Wright and very forcibly demanded a refund, which he did pay out at the total cost of $12,000.
Okay, that's a lot of money. That's a lot.
That he's paying out. I was very surprised that this happened, honestly, that he just paid this, or I mean, I don't know if it was him personally or the company that paid this out as a refund. That's a very large amount of money just to sort of refund there.
I feel like that either has to be he wanted out of the business, or like someone with some connections told him he better do it. You know what I mean?
Well, especially later on, you know, coming up here, I'll just get to it now. Especially looking at, you know, in December 1858, Commodore is sold to California Steam Navigation Company for the price of $40,000. So if you look at how much he refunded these people just for this one trip, that's like a quarter of a whole ship that he's paying for here.
That is a lot of money.
Yeah, I was, I guess, I don't know if impressed is the right word, but I was kind of surprised that they just got their money back.
Mm-hmm.
Good business practices from Mr. Wright here. Under her new owners, the California Steam Navigation Company, she received another overhaul to strengthen her frame and address some rumors of her unseaworthiness. And she also got her old name back. Okay. She was once again Brother Jonathan. On February 14th, 1859, Oregon was admitted to the Union as its 33rd state.
Nice.
And it was Brother Jonathan that first carried this news northward from San Francisco.
She really carries news a lot of places. It's like her thing.
Yeah, she's involved with a lot of stuff. So with this news of statehood, whether this was due to just general indifference or because she arrived at 4:40 a.m. and not a lot of people were probably awake, there was reportedly very little celebration of this statehood announcement in Portland.
Really?
Portland's always got to be weird.
Keep it all weird.
Keep Portland weird. So anyway, Oregon's a state now. Portland was a really, you know, booming economic center at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You've got wheat and wool, some of the major products coming from the farmlands around Portland, in addition to stuff like flour. Lumber, obviously, Pacific Northwest at this time has tons and tons and tons of trees.
A few less every day.
Yep. Some of those trees are very, 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 very big and very old. But at this point, hey, that's just a lot of wood. Portland also saw the development of other those sorts of societal hallmarks that you expect from a city. You've got bakeries, breweries, foundries, print shops, stuff like that. Skyline Chili's. That's all of the good stuff that you want in a city. The Willamette Valley was particularly well known for its wool and its high quality fleece products. Good fleece weather, the Pacific Northwest, I guess.
Good sheep country.
So shipping manifests on the vessels heading south show things like apples, butter, eggs, plums, hides, cattle, and sheep. It's interesting to look at the northbound goods in contrast. First listed here is liquor. Need a lot of that. Liquor, wine, shoes, boots, soap, clothing, tools, hardware, pianos, and brooms.
It's interesting that what you see is a lot of the unprocessed raw material coming out and then a lot of finished goods coming in.
It's kind of a mini version of mercantilism.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's interesting, the contrast in goods there. Going north, you've got all the stuff that you need to get by and then also have a good time, because that's important too. By 1859, Brother Jonathan was starting to show some age, and she was put through another overhaul. This one more thorough than just the strengthening that she'd received a few years earlier. Her old boilers were removed and replaced with two Martin tubular boilers with six furnaces each.
Okay. That doesn't mean a whole lot to me, but it sounds like an upgrade.
Yeah, I think maybe someone interested in engines and engineering might take note of that.
Mm-hmm.
It does sound like a lot of furnaces to keep going. She did, however, keep her original engine. The bottom of the ship was strengthened with a false keel and two bilge keelsuns. Wood enthusiasts may be interested to know that Oregon oak was used for her hull repairs, Douglas fir for her spars, and California redwood for her cabins.
Interesting.
Passenger space was kind of shifted around to accommodate more cargo, so up to 900 tons on completion here. In the newspaper Alta California, she was described as, quote, looking for all the world like the skeleton of some antediluvian megatherium or mastodon raked out from the ruins of an extinct creation. For however much like a singed cat she may look now, she will come out gay as a pink about midsummer.
Interesting.
I don't know what a pink is here in this context, but it must be better than a singed cat.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, that is a... That whole excerpt right there is something.
I read that a couple of times and I was like, is this good?
Yeah,
bad?
I'm still not sure.
Is this a criticism? Some of it sounds cool. Some of it sounds bad. But anyway, she was ready to sail again on December 20th, 1861. And she went about her business without incident for the next 3.5 years.
Okay.
This brings us to the main thrust of today's episode.
Mm-hmm.
The incidents. I'm going to quote here from Lomax to start out. On July 28th, 1865, the day of sailing from San Francisco, Oregon cargo flowed across the terminal and into the ship in ever-increasing volume until it appeared to be on the point of literally bursting the ship's seams. Even casual observers must have been concerned as they watched the load waterline creep higher toward the upper strakes. So this gave me some flashbacks to episode 54.
Uh-huh.
Where Kaylee talked to us about the Benjamin Noble.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got this ship sitting at the dock, and it's just getting more and more and more stuff thrown onto it. You know, talking about passersby, people on the docks, captains, those kinds of people making comments about this. If you've got a ship that's so overloaded that these people who regularly see ships being loaded are concerned, it's a time to worry.
Right.
So, yeah, important to note here, though, that the captain himself had very little say in how the ship was loaded.
Yeah, that's probably not good.
So instead, this judgment was made by the ship's owner and company agents, you know, depending on who's present. And the method used was basically just vibes. A quote here says, so long as she floated, she could go to sea.
Yeah, that like sounds like the company's vibes for loading that thing.
Yeah, that reminds... I think it reminds me of Brother Jonathan. It also, in a way, reminds me of Rusalka.
Yeah.
The idea that, like, everyone knows that this ship cannot actually sail.
Right. But it still happens because it has to.
Mm-hmm. So the captain on this voyage was Samuel DeWolf. So DeWolf reportedly protested against what he saw as the overloading of his ship, noting that she was too low in the water already before any passengers were even aboard.
That's just not good.
Like, I've got more stuff that needs to go on here, actually. And in something that I know we've sort of talked about this in the abstract, but I don't think we've ever seen a case so direct. He's told by the agent who's present at the dock that if he didn't like the way the ship was loaded, there were other qualified captains who would be willing to sail her instead.
Can you imagine if, like, aircraft travel worked that way? Like, hey, you don't want to fly this plane? Guess what? I'll find somebody else that does.
We're literally at an airport right now. I can probably find a pilot who wants to fly this plane. So of all the stuff that's going on to her, some of this cargo included wool mill machinery headed for Ellendale and mining machinery destined for southeastern Oregon and Idaho. Also on board, Brigadier General George Wright, who had served in the U.S. Army during the Mexican War, and he had actually been the overall commander of the Department of the Pacific during the Civil War.
That had to be one of the more cake jobs in the Civil War.
Apparently, he actually did sort of like make requests to be sent east so he could actually get involved in the fighting. But he was, I guess, just able to stay where he is.
Like, if you're in charge of the Pacific in the Civil War, your job is to make sure that, like, none of the Native American people are teaming up with the Confederates, I would imagine. Like, you're just kind of monitoring that situation.
Yeah.
I don't know what you would do.
Yeah. One big thing that he was doing, I did read, was a part of it was recruiting, you know, gathering guys, training guys, so that you could send them east.
I'd imagine particularly people living that lifestyle, that rugged, more frontiers lifestyle, probably make a better soldier. They're already used to, you know, misery.
Yeah, it's quite possible. So yeah, that's what he did. So, you know, he's a pretty high ranking guy if he's in charge of a whole department, even if it is the Pacific during the Civil War. So on this trip, General Wright also had his Newfoundland along with him. If you want a spoiler alert, you can look back to previous episodes and see how well dogs fare in these.
Not as good as horses.
No, we have some of those too in a second here. Speaking of animals, the story gives us one animal that we haven't had a chance to talk about yet on the show. Mm-hmm. It's not quite a horse, but it's kind of like a horse. And it's a camel. It's two camels, actually.
The noted swimming mammal.
Yes, the people swim them across the Sahara Ocean quite frequently. Yeah, there's two camels on board this thing, and they're going to the same place that the mining equipment is. So I'm no assuming way. That they were going to be used as like pack animals for mining stuff.
I would imagine.
And this is probably around the time when Americans are just like, hey, this is a cool animal that they have over in Africa and camels. The Middle East. I'd like to try one. Aren't camels supposed to be like really mean?
Yeah, I think they can be.
Another interesting bit of cargo here was a safe with $200,000 in it.
Okay, that's a lot of money at the time.
The reason it's so much is because this is the whole payroll for the U.S. troops stationed at Fort Vancouver in the Washington Territory. Yeah, so that's on its way up there, too, with General Wright. So Brother Jonathan left San Francisco at noon on the 28th and encountered some fierce winds as soon as she exited the Golden Gate. Around noon on July 38th is not a day. July 30th is what that is supposed to say. Okay. She passed Crescent City and then made it about 12 miles further north to Northwest Seal Rock. So still fighting the wind and waves, Captain DeWolf decided to turn around and shelter in the harbor of Crescent City.
Okay, that makes sense.
This is where they had actually spent the previous night, you know, in the shelter of the harbor. And on coming out and sort of trying their luck today, realized that it really wasn't getting much better.
Right.
So note that this weather they're encountering is heavy wind and waves, but it's not necessarily a storm. You know, darkness and visibility and rain is never really brought up as an issue. It's really is more just about the sea conditions and the wind.
I would imagine also having an overloaded ship isn't doing you any favors in any
for sure. So yeah, it would have taken quite a bit of, you know, seamanship to turn such a heavily laden ship safely in that weather, but DeWolf and the crew are able to do it. However, now we get to the real danger. About halfway back to Crescent City, Brother Jonathan ran at full speed into uncharted rocks on the western end of St. George's Reef. This was a known reef, a well-known danger to shipping in the area. Lomax describes the rocks, quote, like bayonets below the surface, ready to pierce any unlucky craft encountering them. I know they strengthened her hull, but I don't think they made her bayonet-proof. So there was a channel through this area that was, you know, on the charts. That's what they were trying to sail through. It was about my note says it was about a milf and a half wide. And I do think it was wider than that. I think it was about a mile and a half wide and 10 fathoms in depth, or about 60 feet.
So they were doing the right thing. Like, they thought they were in a safe area.
Yeah, so going through this, again, you know, they know that the reef is there. It's just that, you know, this particular outcropping of it maybe isn't on their chart. So, yeah, they're operating in kind of an inherently dangerous area, but trying to do it in a safe way. So on impact with the rocks, passengers were thrown to the deck and a large hole was torn open below her engine room. This also had the effect of bringing down the vessel's foremast, which crashed down onto the deck.
That's not great.
No. So quoting here from the quartermaster on watch, who does survive this incident, says, we ran until 1:50 when she struck with great force, knocking the passengers down and starting the deck planks. The captain stopped and backed her, but couldn't move the vessel an inch. She rolled about 5 minutes, then gave a tremendous thump and part of the keel came alongside. By that time, the wind and sea had slewed her around until her head came out of the sea and worked off a little. Then the foremast went through the bottom until the yard rested on the deck.
Oh, jeez.
Captain DeWolf ordered everyone to look to his own safety and said that he would do the best for all. The thing about the foremast, I guess the way he's describing it to me, it sounds like because of that hole in the bottom, the mast essentially drops through the ship, and the only thing that stops it from falling all the way through is the yardarm.
Right. Yeah, that's the way I understand that, too.
Which is kind of a like a zany image to have in the middle of all of this.
It really is.
But anyway, we have Captain DeWolf. He orders abandoned ship. When I order abandoned ship, it's abandoned ship for everyone.
Yeah, everybody.
The captain's alleged last recorded words were, "Tell them that if they had not overloaded us, we would have got through all right, and this would never have happened."
He might be right.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. And I only include alleged there because none of the sources that have him saying this, I couldn't find who he said this to and who related this. So just because there's no single source of like, who's he saying this to, who recorded this, I'm sure his sentiments were something like that.
It's like too perfect of a quote not to have had it happen.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, regardless of the words said, it's probably something like that. It comes up in the Lomax article near where the quartermaster is quoted, but it isn't attributed to him. So I really don't know. The ship was equipped with sufficient lifeboats for all 244 people aboard that day. Sources don't totally agree on this, but either three or four of these boats were pretty new metal Francis lifeboats. Mm-hmm. These look essentially like the lifeboats you're imagining from like the early 1900s.
Right.
And they're pretty new at the time. And two of them were wooden surf boats. So of the six lifeboats that were launched, only one was able to successfully navigate away from the ship without being swamped.
Yeah, lifeboats are never good. It's not something you want to use.
Yeah, I mean, if any of them work, I mean, that's a win for
yeah, this I really podcast. Feel, I mean, especially at this time where you're basically saying the lifeboats are super unsafe, but we're sinking, like this is the next best option.
Yeah. So this one lifeboat that was successful, this was commanded by third mate James Patterson.
Nice. He went on to have a great career.
He did. So Patterson was actually asleep at the time of the impact, but he managed to get up on deck and get the lifeboat lowered with 19 people aboard, which is really impressive for someone who wasn't even awake when this started. The poise that he shows in that situation.
I guess we can start handing out like the Charles Lightoller Award every week.
That's a good idea.
This man's the winner.
I like that.
This week.
So these 19 people, this included 5 women, 3 children, 10 crewmen, and Patterson himself. So these 19 men, women, and children in Patterson's lifeboat would reach Crescent City around 4 p.m., and they would be the only survivors of the Brother wow. Jonathan. Again, you know, like you just said, if there's obviously one person that we can give a lot of credit to, it's James Patterson here. And like in some stories we've talked about before, if not for the actions of this one person, quite probably no one survives this.
Right.
The sinking of Brother Jonathan was the worst maritime tragedy on the West Coast up to that point, and it obviously resonated throughout the region.
Mm-hmm.
Flags were flown at half-staff all the way up the coast to Victoria. All of these West Coast passenger ships, they made these regular stops at all these port cities.
Right.
Up and down the coast, you know, California, Oregon, Washington, even into British Columbia, this loss would have been felt. You know, people ashore are going to know these crew, they're going to know these ships, and they're going to feel that absence. You know, a lot of the people living in these, you know, new states and new territories would have gotten to where they were on the Brother Jonathan. Captain DeWolf was a respected ship's master who was pretty well connected in West Coast society. Lots of people knew him. Lots of people liked him. And the loss of General Wright was an obvious blow to the military community. You know, he reportedly urged his wife repeatedly to leave him and get to the safety of a lifeboat. They were last seen together with life preservers strapped around them. Their bodies washed up together at Trinidad, around 50 miles south of the wreck site.
Mm-hmm.
General Wright's dog and his favorite horse also perished in the sinking. So in this case, horse was not able to swim to safety. On rare occasion for the podcast, usually they do pretty well.
Yeah, usually they do.
I do want to be clear here, just to be fair, play devil's advocate a little bit. General Wright was something of a shitbag in his dealings with the Yakima tribe, so karma, I guess. It sucks for the animals, sucks for his wife. I don't know. Right. I'm not the arbiter of fate. Anyone at the rank of brigadier general in the West at this point is probably committing crimes against humanity on a daily basis
against
Native Americans. So who knows?
I think one thing that's interesting here is that there's no male passengers that survive. It's like one of the only stories we've ever told where like women and children fare better than the average man on board mm-hmm. that isn't a crew member.
And there's not much in terms of detail about those failed lifeboats, why they failed. Mm-hmm. If we're going off of precedent from stories that we've covered before, a lot of times when lifeboats, you know, fail to launch properly, it's because either they're not manned by any of the crew at all, or the crew is panicking. You know, they're not communicating well. They're not doing this in a measured fashion, and something goes wrong with the launch. Yeah, again, there's no real details about why that happened, but you have to think the possibility of if too many people are trying to get to one of these, if the people launching them aren't actually trained to do this, if this is just passengers trying to do this, it's not going to go very well.
It's the Oceanus problem. You need some of the crew in the lifeboats, mm-hmm. not all of the crew.
Exactly. Another noteworthy individual on board was James Nisbet, the editor of the San Francisco Bulletin. He was on his way to Victoria to obtain evidence in a libel lawsuit. When he understood how grave the situation was, he actually sat down and composed his will, which I'll read here, kind of just in admiration of how poised it sounds, like given the situation.
Right.
So he says, "At sea on board Brother Jonathan, July 30th, 1865. In view of death, I hereby grant my brother Thomas Nisbet, at present engaged on the Pacific Railroad near Clipper Cap, California, my sole executor, with instructions to wind up my sole estate, real and personal, and convert the same into cash with all convenient speed, but so as not to sacrifice the same, and to pay over and divide the same equally between himself and my sole sister, Margaret Nisbet, now residing in England. And under burden of the payment of a legacy of $5,000 in gold to Elmira Hopkins, wife of Casper Hopkins, insurance agent, San Francisco, California. And I desire that my brother, said Thomas Nisbet, shall not be asked to give security for his intromissions with my estate." So he manages to write that all out as he's on a sinking ship and is pretty sure he's going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's found on his body 2 days later.
Interesting.
However, unfortunately, the will was rejected by California courts on account of a lack of witnesses.
Huh.
After all that,
it doesn't count.
Also on board was Anson G. Henry, who was the governor and former surveyor general of Washington Territory.
Okay.
Anson Henry was also really close friends with Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Had been friends with Abraham Lincoln. And not like a political hanger-on either. He'd met Lincoln in 1833 when Henry was in Illinois helping to treat cholera outbreaks in the area. So they'd been friends for a long time, well before Abraham Lincoln was a household name. They were very good friends. And Mary Todd Lincoln, who obviously at this point is still mourning the death of her own husband, wrote a letter to Henry's wife in the weeks after the accident. And the opening part of that letter reads, "My very dear Mrs. Henry, bowed down and brokenhearted, and feeling so deeply for you in your agonizing bereavement, I feel justified in approaching you at this time when we all feel alike crushed. We've both been called upon to resign to our Heavenly Father two of the best men and the most devoted husbands that two unhappy women ever possessed."
That's a really cool letter, like knowing that they're both kind of going through the same things at that time.
Yeah, like you've got Mary Todd Lincoln, who is like the nation's widow mm-hmm. at this point, trying to comfort, you know, someone else who's lost her husband. It's a very interesting letter. That's something I'll put in the show notes, is the letter in its entirety, but it's definitely worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the other aftermath of this. So a lighthouse was built on Northwest Seal Rock in 1891. That cost $750,000.
Wow.
Which is a ton of money.
Yeah, that is a lot of money.
I believe I read that's over like $20 million in today's money. It's the most expensive lighthouse in U.S. history. Several people actually died just during the construction of it. Mm-hmm. And she was a notoriously difficult place to work because of the isolation and the very dangerous seas in the area. It was very hard to get to. It really is like your stereotypical like secluded lighthouse where you would go insane.
Like the lighthouse from the lighthouse.
Yeah, and like murder your assistant lightkeeper or something. The light actually operated until 1975, when she was functionally replaced by a floating lighthouse buoy. And this was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1993. Now, funny thing about all that is that this wasn't necessarily added because of this, but they're kind of attached because of the area. The conditions were pretty clear. A lighthouse probably wouldn't have helped this particular accident because that wasn't really the problem. They knew where they were. They had a chart. It was just this particular rock was not on it.
Right.
So that was, you know, something that was done to try and make that area, though, a little bit safer to traverse. So getting into the rediscovery of the wreck and some legal battles of interest here. So as in the story of Central America, any ship that's known to have been carrying significant amounts of coin is going to be a primary target for treasure hunters.
Right.
In 1993, the wreckage of Brother Jonathan was discovered by the underwater exploration group Deep Sea Research. The ship was found about 2 miles away from the expected location that had been searched by previous shipwreck hunters. So in addition to being out of place, quote unquote, the ship lay at a depth of 275 feet. Not something that you're going to casually stumble upon.
Right, right.
You know, like a fisherman or a diver or something. So after some legal battles between DSR and the state of California regarding the ownership of the wreckage, the U.S. Supreme Court found unanimously in favor of DSR. California did threaten to continue legal action, and so a settlement was reached in which DSR handed over 200 of the gold coins from the wreck. DSR auctioned off the remaining coins, or at least some of the remaining coins, in order to pay their own bills, which were pretty significant. These auctions yielded $5.3 million.
Nice.
At an average of over $5,000 per coin.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. So there's some interesting details about that court case that are definitely worth discussing. Thought we could have that discussion over on Patreon. So we'll be producing some bonus content off of this one. So if you're interested in, you know, hearing about that sort of back and forth legal case, you know, starting in the California courts and heading all the way up to the Supreme Court, join us over on Patreon. That will be some of our bonus content for the month of May. We will still have a normal bonus episode as well, but we want to have that discussion just to save a little bit of time from this episode because it is a bit more of a niche interest. So really, that is the story of Brother Jonathan.
Yeah, that's a good one. It's a very interesting story. It's kind of got a little bit of everything in it. It has like the kind of classic shipwreck story, but of course there's some gold coins, you know, everything to keep it interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was a very interesting one to research. Had to read about a lot of stuff. Had to read about a lot of legal stuff I didn't really understand going into it. So that was a lot of fun. But yeah, that was a good story to tell. Glad we were able to cover it. So if there's no other final thoughts here, I guess we'll just sign off and I'll share our social media. If you're interested in interacting with us at all on social media, we're on Twitter at @beyond_breakers. We're on Instagram at @beyondthebreakerspodcast. Our email is beyondthebreakerspod@gmail.com. And again, we are on Patreon. That's patreon.com/beyondthebreakers. If you want to enjoy a little bit more content each month while also helping to support the show, head over to Patreon and join up at the $3 or $5 tiers. Those Patreon episodes cover a range of topics. We might watch a maritime-related movie and discuss it. We might talk about some non-standard wrecks. And we might have expansions on main feed episodes, like what we'll be doing with this one. So with all that being said, thank you for listening, and we will talk to you next week.